brought to you by the Fetzer Institute, helping to build a spiritual foundation for a loving world. Welcome, everybody, to the Wonder It All podcast. I'm Louis Schwartzberg, and this is a series that takes you on a journey into the soul. My guest today is Rita Sharma. Rita is the founding director and associate professor at the Center for Dharma Studies, core doctoral faculty, department chair of theology and ethics, and the co-chair of Sustainability 360 Initiatives and the Graduate Theological Union in Berkeley, California. Formerly, she was Swami Vivekananda, the visiting professor in Hindu studies at USC. She is the co-founder and vice president of Dharma Academy of North America, an academic forum which explores in multidisciplinary ways the cultures, religious lives, philosophies, art, ritual, and contemporary applications of the religions born in India. Dr. Sharma has authored, co-edited numerous books and is the founding editor-in-chief of Journal of Dharma Studies and serves as an advisor to the Parliament of the World's Religions, Climate, and Action-Sponsored Faith for the Earth Online and Print Project. Rita, thank you so much for joining us on at Wonder and Awe to be having a cool conversation about your life, how you got into exploring, I think, the convergence of nature and spirituality.
Pleasure to be here, Louis. Thank you for having me.
So I'm curious, when was the first time that you were wowed by nature?
You know, recently I lost my father, and he was a wonderful man. And our hometown was Montreal, Canada. And in those days, you know, dirt was dirt cheap. And so we had a home on a very large plot. And he said to me, we need to, you know, let's dig up this place, plant some trees, and put some fencing up. And I'm 10 years old, and I'm like, whatever daddy says, good for me. And the two of us went through nearly 200 feet of fencing, after which we planted hedges for 200 feet, and then we planted poplar trees, birch trees, blue spruce, and all manner of plants and trees, and I became familiar with all of them. And then he had to go to work in summer, and he said, guess who's in charge of the garden? And then we would go camping and hiking in the woods around and the forests around, you know, the western edge of Montreal, to the lake. You know, Montreal's an island, and it was so, so beautiful. So it was those childhood experiences with my dad roaming around looking for wild strawberries that really started my love for being in the natural world and thinking of ourselves not as distinct from the natural world, but as integral and part of it.
Yeah. Well, so you, I know that you studied, you know, Hindu religion. I think you had a Hindu guru. And I'm curious, as you grew up and you had this fondness for nature, but you were also studying religion. What do you think influenced you in this idea of eco-spirituality? Was it the upbringing in that Hindu society, or was it your experience and connection one-on-one with nature?
I would say that my studies of the Hindu world were so much later. I already had two children, and my son has a developmental disability. It's a learning disability. And I worked with him one-on-one intensely for a long time. And I found nature really helped. Being in the wilderness, we learned all the plants and different insects and all manner of things. And his entire cognitive process changed. So I would have to say that it has always been my personal connection with wilderness and with the environment that is around us, the attempt to rewild our gardens and so forth. These are the things that led me into this search and eventually into the study of religion, and not just Hinduism, but Buddhism, Christianity, and other traditions, but always from that viewpoint of what does it have to say about the natural world?
So what do you mean by eco-spirituality?
So the thing is that our spiritual traditions have disagree on a lot of things, and they have fought wars and continue to do so on a lot of matters, disagreements, and sometimes it's just about land. But when it comes to appreciation for the earth, for God's creation, or if you're Buddhist or Jain or Shinto, just for the sacrality of this remarkable place that inspires wonder and awe. In that place, in that moment, these spiritual traditions that are hundreds or thousands of years old agree. And that is where the sweet spot is. And that's what started my work in interreligious eco-spirituality. So eco-spirituality can be, it's exactly what you've been talking about, which is the wonder and awe in face of something far greater than ourselves. And we have today, psychologists are overloaded with people with climate anxiety, climate trauma, and eco-anxiety, in addition to, you know, standard psychological issues. And this is not just people who experience the horrors of climate change like California wildfires. These are people who have not experienced anything like that, but fear it and expect it. And that has created, we're having generations coming up with this eco-anxiety, climate trauma. What religion can do and what spirituality beyond religion can do is precisely this, what you're speaking of, is give us that sense of something greater than ourselves, the wonder and awe at the majesty of creation. That can give us a sense of the possibility of the earth rejuvenating itself and the possibility of humanity recovering our senses, so to speak, in both ways that can be interpreted.
Yeah, well, we have to have hope. And nature, I think, teaches us with evolution that things continue to strive to have life flourish, you know? And so I totally agree with you. The issue with, you know, young people, especially that are environmental leaders, there's a certain sense of despair because you carry the weight of the world on your shoulder. You have the science in front of you that basically saying is that the path we're on right now with climate change, et cetera, is environmental degradation, loss of species. It can be very, very depressing. That's only logical that it would be. But in order to fight the good fight, I think what you talked about was that the spiritual energy, or you can call it religion, but it's really for me spiritual energy that gives you the inspiration to fight the good fight, to not let yourself get down, and to actually give you the energy to be in, because you have to be inspired from the inside out, you know, whether it was Gandhi, the Dalai Lama, you know, it's like you have to have peace within before you can exude peace externally to help yourself first, your family, community, the world. And so I think this is such an important conversation that you're having with the world, in that religion / spirituality can be really, maybe it's the perfect step forward in dealing with environmental degradation.
Absolutely, Louis. And the thing is that what we have found, in at least in my research, is that there are many projects across the world where religions are cooperating. So there's interreligious projects across the world in terms of forest regeneration or assistance to indigenous people for protecting their lands because they're the best caretakers. There's also an entire worldwide phenomenon, which is the the appropriation of the idea of sentience and the application of it to rivers that are considered sacred to different traditions. You know, the word religion is so problematic because it was developed in a way to box people in categories, and it's been used to oppress and, you know, enact violence upon people of different what are called religions. And so I have Jewish friends, Buddhist friends, Hindu friends who will say, no, no, we're not a religion, okay? This is a way of life, or this is a culture, this is an approach to reality. It's a perspective on the cosmos and all of these terms. And I'm thinking that, you know, if we could sort of elicit that from people, pull that out of institutionalization and place it where it belongs, in that great, wild, beautiful creation, everything changes. Because what we forget is all of the things we call religions have a source, and those sources are individuals who experience something greater than what is in front of their nose, greater than something that can be measured, greater than what we can develop from the data we gather from our five senses, greater than all of this. And many were unable to find a word for it, and they found different words for it. But that sense is not unique to these early people, hundreds of thousands or thousands of years ago. That can happen to you when you stand on a mountaintop. It can happen to me sitting in front of the Pacific. It can happen to anyone at any time. And there are two paths to this that are very effective. One is the contemplative life. And I will explain that a little more later. And the second is just being in contact and communion with the more than human world, to use David Abrams' famous term. And if we can't get to the Redwoods and we can't get to Sedona, I always say, if you don't believe in something divine, just go to Sedona and you will, you know? And so if we are unable to do that, if we're living in an urban concrete jungle, we still have a pot, a tree, a plant, and just the engagement with something that grows, that is dependent on the sun and the rain and your care. Just that alone can inspire you to feel very differently about one's place in the universe.
Yeah, well, because I think it's easy to be arrogant that the human point of view is the only point of view. If you experience other points of view, plants, animal, hummingbird, whatever, and that's what I try to do when I show films of slow-mo for a hummingbird and time-lapse for a flower, that's their world, their metabolic rate, their energy vibration is different. And I prove the fact what I'm saying is true. So, you know, like plants move, you know, flowers move. You know, the blue zones, they did the study on all those regions of the world that people aren't familiar. It's a great book where people have lived the longest lives. And what was common in all five zones all over the world was when people get up in the morning, they tend their garden. Before they have breakfast, before they do anything important, they connect. And I do the same thing because I've got these time-lapse cameras going 24 hours a day, seven days a week for almost four decades. So I pop out of bed and I'm very curious to know, did the flower open? Is it in focus? You know, did I get a good shot or did it die? Is there a bug? And it gets you out of bed in the morning. And I never thought about it until very recently, but you could define it. It's my practice. I did it more like I was just passionate about doing it. Yeah. And So I think that what you're saying is really critical to be connected to a garden. And you're right, in the city, it can be a back. You can grow a tomato in a pot on a back porch. And that experience, especially for a child, is one that'll open her heart forever by being connected to reality, like the natural world.
You know, when you said it's your practice, I wanted to share something with you that you won't be familiar with. Our students, when they see your work, this was a contemplative experience. This is precisely, it's practice for you, and it's contemplative practice for those who view it. You know, you're taking people into another world. And that's what we need to stop the despair and to mitigate that eco-anxiety, that climate trauma. Because as you said right at the beginning, we can't do anything without the energy of hope and conviction. Mm-hmm. And that's not going to come just by logocentric, you know, thinking words and sentences.
Yeah. Well, I love the fact that you're a fighter, because, like, didn't you help sort of enact laws or talk about the idea that, like, a river deserves to have its own, let's say, legal representation for protection?
Yes. I've been involved in that for many, many years. And the thing is that, so I'll just share a story with you. You asked me if any of my connection to ecology comes from my Hindu tradition, but you know, I grew up in Canada, in French Canada, and that space, the wilderness there, was sacred to me. But what I found when I began to study my own tradition, which, you know, for my father, God was in these forests. God was in his poplar trees that he planted. You know, God was in the ladybug he picked off his tomato, you know. So we had a spiritual home, but not a religious home. But when I studied my tradition, I was amazed that 4,000 years ago, people of this tradition in this vast subcontinent from the Himalayas to the Indian Ocean were concerned about the land. There are verses that are almost 4,000 years old that says, I have to dig into you, Mother Earth, but may I not hit your vital spot? May I not hit your heart? You know, and it's very moving. And when they would cut a tree, they would leave enough of the stump. They'd do a ritual on it. They would come and water it so that it would grow back. And there are so many, the nature, or I don't like to say nature and, you know, culture or humanity and nature, because I see ourselves as part of nature. But just for convenience, I would say that the natural world in the Hindu sense is the location of revelation. It's where revelation keeps occurring in a continual river through time. And the expectation is that revelation will continue to occur. And because it has always occurred in forests and mountains and on rivers, the texts are full of these vibrant descriptions. And what happens, and I'll give you an example of this so it's clear what I'm talking about. So people are familiar with this, the name Krishna. Krishna is a divine, is considered to be a divine incarnation, you know, God descendant in human form. We're familiar with this from other traditions. But those who are devotionally, in a loving devotional relationship with Krishna, those particular theological schools, they look at this period of time of his adolescence and childhood, which is in this rural area, and he is playing under the full moon, the autumn moon, with cowherdesses and cowherds. And they describe the all the animals, the buzzing of the bees, the scent of the jasmine, the appearance of the moon on the river Yamuna, all of this is so clearly described that exquisite art and sculpture has arisen from this. And people can read this, and for them, it transcends time. And they walk back into sacred space and transcendent time. And then they want to create it in the here and now. And there's eco-villages they have created all over the world. And the most famous of them is Govardhan Eco-Village. It received a United Nations World Tourism Organization Award for Sustainable Tourism. And it does amazing work. The president of our university and myself, we went there. And what we learned is that these ancient descriptions elicit imagination. Imagination leads to this contemplation. The contemplation leads to transformation, a transformed consciousness, the development of an eco-consciousness, an eco-awareness, which leads to the development of animal care, eco-villages, rewilding projects. It's amazing.
Wow. Right there, it sounds like the new Ten Commandments, you know, based on nature's intelligence and biomimicry. I always look at that stuff and I go, this is a blueprint. It's right under our feet. This is how we should live our lives.
Yes.
Yeah, the whole mycelial network and fantastic fungi kind of laid out the idea there's ecosystems can flourish with the sharing of information and nutrients without greed.
No, I was thinking about when I was saying fantastic fungi, I was also thinking that trees, we forget we think of trees as individual, you know, things, entities. And yet we know now from botany that there are mother trees and that when their offspring, which have come either from their seeds or from their roots, are in distress, these trees send sap and nutrients, you know, through that system, through the underground system of roots. And so the relationship between trees, the community between trees, is also something that came to mind when I was watching Fantastic Fungi.
So what was really, I think, incredible also, because we're talking about films, but, you know, you mentioned, I think at one point, you know, the Bose Institute, you know, and do you know that, like, when I worked on The Secret Life of Plants, that was the very first film I ever worked on. I had never traveled out of the country. I was living in Northern California, and I had this assignment to go to Calcutta, of all places, when you've never traveled out of the U.S. And I did the sequence with J.C. Bose, who I think in India, they consider him to be almost like, I don't know, the father of modern science in India, perhaps in the world, the one who discovered there's consciousness, that plants have the same type of tissue that animals do, that plants and animals are, you know, related to each other, which I'm sure had a giant influence, given the fact that he's Hindu, that he would have seen the fact. It's ridiculous to think that back in 1930, you know, that the scientific community thought that plants almost like weren't alive and didn't have the same kind of, you know, biological reactions. And so I just got to say, I went all the way to Calcutta to shoot those interiors, carrying 35 millimeter film with me, which had I been arrested, it was considered a tool of propaganda and I would have gone to jail just for having film with me. That was during the period of Indira Gandhi. But I'm shooting this machine that he built. That's a giant invention. So you have a test tube with a ball of cotton and you have a blade of grass growing out of it. And connected to the blade of grass is this horsehair tied to like a metal rod. And when you add sugar water to the cotton, the blade grows. And then it moves the rod, which scratches an arc into some smoked glass. And thereby he proved that plants respond to like sugar just as animal tissue responds to sugar. i.e., it sounds like we're pretty similar to one another.
He had written about this at risk to his own reputation, because he has such a, you know, strong international reputation. But he couldn't help writing about it because it was supported by his own research, as you just so helpfully explained to us. But he had also written in private letters that the idea came to him because of the concept of sentience being ubiquitous across the living world, across the biosphere, across the ecosphere. And so this in the sacred text that he grew up with. And it was, you know, when he grew up with this, it was like, could this be true? Is this possible or is this garbage? You know, is this a superstition of some primitive people 2,000 years ago, 4,000 years ago? Let me find out. And then he did all of his experiments, and he was amazed. And he said, even if it destroys my reputation and credibility, I have to share this because it's truth. Mm-hmm. I'm an eco-theologian, and I write about eco-theology. I also write about it comparatively, or eco-spirituality, if you will. And I look at a particular tradition in the Hindu world, which is the tradition of the divine feminine. And that theology is very interesting because it says the divine is not just transcendent. The divine is a source. Whatever you consider the source, a source of this cosmos, that we can call divine. But that divine has to also be the matter-energy continuum. The matter-energy continuum we see has responsiveness, awareness, and responsiveness. Without that, molecules would never form. If atoms were inert and dead, so to speak, dead matter, molecules would never form. The idea of the Shakta theology, which is, you know, it starts about 4,000 years ago in the Vedas, in a very famous hymn called the Devi Suktam, which people still sing. Then in about 500 CE, it becomes crystallized. And this is the idea that a consciousness that we can call source or divine enters into something that it also is, which is matter, bringing with it a certain thrust, a teleological thrust towards biopotentiality. These are my terms, these are English words, but I'm actually translating Sanskrit terms. And so when I originally thought this from my study of ecology and botany and all of these related areas, and then I read the theology and I said, oh my goodness. I had a reverse Bose moment, if you know what I mean. And so the idea here is that this is why we see extremophiles. You know, these, how in the sulfur around the edges of volcanoes, you have, bacteria or some sort of life forms that are arising, right? There are forms of bacteria that are arising that arose on the Chernobyl nuclear reactor that were eating the radiation, that were consuming radiation. These are extremophiles. This is a kind of a, I don't want to use the word evidence, I'm not a scientist, but it kind of makes us contemplate this thought that biopotentiality could be inherent in matter, that the possibility of life could be inherent in matter itself. And that possibility, as it emerges, expands, evolves, and becomes conscious, is that we can look at that or think of that as an eco-spiritual people, as the divine becoming.
I love it. I'm totally there. I mean, when I think of, what makes, atoms, the electrons, revolve around each other, and having that be similar to the, our solar system, and similar to nebulas. I mean, the same, physics.
Yes.
Same energy, the same patterns and rhythms, vibrations and wavelengths are replicated throughout the universe. Even the other day, it just blows my mind. I go, this whole idea about gravity. I mean, like if, what did ancient peoples, really think other than Newton, for example, like the fact that things have mass and weight and connect and attract, and what a miracle it is that things do what they do when you have a real open mind to the energy of it. And that's what I think Einstein did. He said that, if you can't stand wrapped in awe and filled with wonder, your eyes are closed, you might as well be dead.
Yes.
So having that sense of wonder is really the core intersection with art and science, I think, as well.
If you look at great scientists, Einstein, Tesla, not the car, and people like Paul Davies, who is a famous physicist, and you look at their work, and I see theologians here. So this term has a negative connotation. People think somebody sits there in a library, creates this thing out of their heads, out of whole cloth, called theology, then they use it to whack other people over the head with and commit genocide with.
Right.
But if we look at theology very differently, if we look at our attempt to express in awe and wonder what we experience in as the opening of life in this world, and the truth that science brings to us about physical reality, as that grows and that elicits wonder and awe, the more our theology or spiritual philosophy can adapt and grow with that. It's not something cast in stone. Eco-spirituality is a way of understanding everything that we encounter, all the new knowledge that we develop, all the ancient epistemologies, that means knowledge systems, ways of knowing, that we discover and unearth and find, that they have inspiring resources. We put all of this together, a kind of a pattern emerges. That pattern changes the way we experience the earth and our place in it. That is eco-spirituality.
It's also called science, because science looks at patterns, and they have now algorithms and all kinds of things. I mean, that's the secret sauce, being able to determine what are patterns. Of course, I love patterns from an artistic point of view. The things that I film are really just rhythms and patterns, which are a fingerprint of the universe. Everything I shoot is like ripples on the water. Where did that come from? Well, the scientists would say it's because of the moon having gravitational pull on the ocean, and that creates this, climates like wind, and it creates all this like surface tension on the water, and we get this ripple that looks really cool. On the other hand, it's just energy.
Yes.
It's just energy, and I can just be like amazed and maybe get sucked into the mystery and not have to have a theology or a scientific explanation for what it is.
Yes.
I mean, that's what I think I'm discovering, is like, that's the ultimate thing. You're on the edge of wonder and awe. You're feeling bliss, like you say, of revelation. You're in the world of revelation, and you want to bring that back, is what you said earlier, And maybe that's where, theology and religions were created, because we needed to figure out how to maintain that revelation. You pointed out really beautifully, which I never knew, about these eco spots, places in nature that are extreme and sacred, where it enables more revelation. Well, so there you are standing on the cliff of Big Sur, wherever it might be, experiencing revelation. And my question to you is, do you need to go further? Or is it just okay to be there?
I think the answer is yes to both. And the reason is this, that we have to meet people where they are at, you know, where they're most comfortable. And when we talk about, someone can just ask us, we're having this conversation, and they can say to us, Louis, Rita, why are you having this conversation? I mean, why do we care about equal spirituality? Why do we even care about wonder and awe? And we would have to explain this to them, because it's not just because we like it. It makes us feel good. That's not an answer. The answer is that it alters your perception of reality. It alters your perception of your place in the human world and in the more than human world. Why does that matter? Well, if you care about the survival of your children and grandchildren, or just the human species, or the rest of the planet, then you have to acknowledge the climate crisis. You have to acknowledge the sixth mass extinction that's going on, the toxicity of our groundwater, our air, our soil, the disappearance of our soil, the absolute, you know, ubiquity of nanoplastics being everywhere on the planet, including our own bodies, and the harm that it's doing to every living being, including whoever's asking us that question. And so my answer to them is there in my recent book. It's so in June, it was released. The name of the book is Religion and Sustainability, Interreligious Resources, Interdisciplinary Responses. And it's in the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals series of Springer's Publishers Compact. And we brought together, you know, so many traditions and so many disciplines, you know, fields, to talk to each other about resources. And what I say to people who say that religion has caused great harm, and continues to do so, and I don't need religion to help mitigate the world's problems, and I would say to them, that's wonderful, you know, have a good life, I'm happy to help you. But the fact is that if you really want to make a difference, you can't leave 81% of the human population behind, okay? So you and I are one, you know, two people. And maybe we don't need it. Maybe we just need to look at our, you know, work with the soil beneath our feet. But 81% of the human population is affiliated with a religion. And it means something to them. It gives meaning to their lives. They're within this paradigm. If you want the world to change, if you want to move through and cut through human recalcitrance and denial of the science that blares at our ears the truth of the disaster we have wrought, you cannot leave out any resources, not film, not art, not music, not religion, nothing. All resources, all hands must be on deck. And so the 81% of the human population that find their meaning in religion must be brought on board. And therefore, we must get their leaders to think, their thinkers to contemplate, their contemplatives to tell us what it is they're receiving when they're in this state of wonder and awe, and then transmit it to this 81%, because only then will we have true human transformative action, and then there is true hope.
Wow. I love that because it expresses compassion and listening and building bridges, which no matter what is what we have to do from a political or religious or spiritual point of view. You know, you have to build bridges and be good listeners. And you're right. And I guess all those religions started as a beautifully passionate spiritual revelation, you know, that someone had 1,000 years ago or 2,000 years ago. And then it became, you know, we all know, more commodified and turned into a business, basically, without being judgmental. I'm not being negative. But when you have an operation that big, like any corporation, it's a corporation. and it's easy to lose your soul.
Yes. And the thing is, there's also, we have to also think about, you know, this is, so right now we have the war in Ukraine. The first thing I do in the morning is go outside, just like you. But the second thing I do is look up what is the latest news on Ukraine. I am so concerned. My heart is broken by what's happening in Ukraine. I didn't live through the Second World War. My grandparents did. But we're living through it now in Ukraine. And so what made me think about this issue is that when you don't have a transformative capacity, when these beautiful revelations from hundreds or thousands of years ago are lost, you know, this is almost like a lost knowledge system. It's like when we discover a ship under, you know, hundreds of feet of water and there's gold bullion in it. And that's what these traditions are. There's gold bullion in there. Mm-hmm. And you can say, why can't we, you know, create more gold bullion? Well, because there was a systematic methods that were used to create that gold bullion, to elicit that knowledge, to elicit that insight, to create those principles. There were systems of thinking, conceptualizing, and manifesting in embodied ways. We have lost that. And all we have left is the carcass. And that's the institutional religion, or that's the ship that's rotting.
I'm glad you're like totally honest about it. No, I think it's beautiful because here you are as someone who is studies theology, an expert in, and certainly a very important voice in the world of academia. And it's not usual that, you know, people are very, you know, forthright and honest about some of the things that people are kind of scared to say, you know, because as you pointed out, like, this is an all hands on deck moment, and we can't, you know, tiptoe around and make sure we're not going to like offend anybody left or right. You know, this is a hands on deck moment. And if the science is right, whether it's 20 years, 50 years, that's not even a nanosecond in time, right, to get our act together. And I think we both agree that falling in love with nature is a way to protect the environment, to create a sustainable future. I mean, we believe that to be true. Other spiritual practices, as you pointed out and you studied, that was their gold bullion as well. They would never poison the well, you know? They would never like poison the ground that they're standing on or the food that they get. That's called suicide. And civilizations did kill themselves. Sometimes it's a mystery as to why they did. A lot of times it was greed when civilizations collapsed. Mm-hmm. So I just applaud you for doing that. And I think that I just want to share also, I think that, you know, when we're talking about nature and nature films, you know, so much of it is very macho. If we're going to get, you know, politically, you know, correct here for a moment, only because the story of kill or be killed, you know, survival of the fittest. It's a dog-eat-dog world out there. It's just really echoing the imperialistic mantra that they ripped off from Darwin in 1930s to invade third world countries. Darwin was a botanist. That was all about connection. And connection and micro relationships is the feminine story of nature. It's pollination, it's symbiosis, relationships, nurturing, giving birth. This is what makes the world go round, you know? And it's beautiful. But, you know, it isn't the drama, which does exist, right, of, you know, kill or be killed. But even a kill or be killed is just survival in a sense so that, you know, a lion can feed its cubs. But again, people are scared to go to nature. They think they're going to get attacked by a bear. They'd be blessed if they could ever see a bear. And I just, you know, wanted to applaud you because I think what you're doing, you're bringing the feminine perspective of nature, I think, to the table to be eco-warriors. Don't you agree?
Yes, and I'm even afraid to use the term warrior.
Okay, peaceful warrior.
Peaceful warriors, yes. Warriors of the light, as Paulo Coelho says. The thing is that I want to talk for a second with you about this philosophy called ecofeminism. And it started out in the 1970s by a French philosopher, a woman called Françoise Dobon, in the early 70s, in 72, I think it was. And then after that, it was developed by philosophers and women theologians in the West, but it quickly spread to the Global South. And women in the Global South picked it up. And it has become an intercultural, interspiritual, international kind of approach. The reason that it's important is it's the first philosophy that actually saw the connection between the oppression of one thing and the destruction of another that we think is unrelated. And so ecofeminism showed, it didn't just, you know, spout this off as, you know, an opinion, but it showed through the literature of science, you know, citing the literature of science and religion to show that nature has often been associated with embodiment and women, the feminine, you know, Mother Nature, right? And the problem with that is that the approaches to nature have been, therefore, misogynistic. You know, you see these old manuals and it says we must ravage nature, we must rip from her and say, we must rip from her womb this whatever materials. And so a lot of these early philosophers, these women, found these texts and they were horrified. And they said, it all makes sense that the oppression of women and the exploitation of nature are linked by a certain perspective. But then ecofeminism expanded and said, imperialism, colonialism, racism, everything is linked to the exploitation and desecration of nature. Because if you can't honor someone who is your own mother, your sister, your daughter, you're going to go and honor the spotted owl? I don't think so. So if you can't honor women, you're not going to honor people of different races, ethnicities, genders, you know, everything, religions, whatever. And you are not going to honor different species, different ecosystems, things that don't feel like yourself. So this, as you said, it's like, it's not masculinity, it's a kind of a toxic understanding of man's place in the world. And, you know, because masculinity is nurturing too. You know, father, I just talk about my father who just passed, the most nurturing human being I've met in my life. And he was very strong. It's not about crushing things to prove one's strength.
Yeah.
Whether you're a man or a woman or LGBTQ.
I said so, macho. Maybe I, yes. More than masculine, but macho can be by women or men, and men can be also compassionate, nurturing, and loving. I mean, we have it both inside of us, but I think you're right. It's the perspective. You know, to have a relationship with anyone that's extractive, that I'm just going to take from you and I'm not going to give anything back to you. Now, that's not a relationship you'd want to have with anybody, but that's the relationship we've had with nature in terms of, you know, the materialistic approach of taking resources and, you know, doing all that destruction is like, I'm just going to grab as much as I can. So that's not the relationship you'd want to have with any other human being.
You know, Louis, the way you said that reminds me of this ongoing kind of battle between those who say we should have a rights-based order and those who say we should have a responsibilities-based order. And those who say we should have a responsibilities-based order say, if all of us fulfilled our responsibilities, and if we have a social structure, a political structure, a policy structure that encourages and enforces that, then everyone's rights would also be taken care of.
Right.
If you and I fulfilled our responsibilities to everyone in our world, their rights are being taken care of. It's as simple as that. If you have a rights-based order, then you have to prove that a tree has a right, that a squirrel has a right, etc. But if you have a responsibilities approach, then it becomes incumbent upon you and me to ask, what is our responsibility to the earth, to the biosphere, to the ecosphere, to everyone, to everything?
Yeah, I don't think you can be, you know, environmentally conscious and, let's say, socially unjust. That's like an impossibility. Either you have compassion and kindness for all living things, or you don't. You know, and realize it's all connected, and you don't have that concept of other, whether it's like, you know, a plant, a bird, or another race, or whatever it might be. We're all connected, and I'm going to respect you because I realize that it's in my own self-interest, as well as it's the ethical thing and the moral thing to do.
And we're interconnected. You know, it was brought home to us vividly and viscerally during the pandemic. We couldn't be in the same room together because your breath would become mine and my breath would become yours. We'd become part of your body.
Right.
And it may not, and if I have COVID, you're done for. You know, I mean, it's simple as that. We are so interconnected. And yet it seems, people seem to have a very difficult time understanding that. And it's this radical individualism, a disconnected, unrelated, unconditioned approach to life, which is, it's not even scientifically correct. It's not experientially correct.
Right.
It's not ethically correct. It's not spiritually correct.
Yeah. If people are listening and want to take a deeper dive into these concepts, where do you suggest they start?
Well, there is a lot of books on ecology and religion. It's a field. You know, I'm a member of the advisory board for the Yale University Forum on Religion and Ecology, for example. And I would recommend to people who are allergic to the word religion to bracket that discomfort, because religion is a word that was created. What you really have is global cultures and global civilizations and a pluriverse of ideas and concepts of our place in the world. And these things, since they are so connected, I would suggest that people start by reading books that are looking at these connections. Books like, I can name a few authors like Walter Mignolo, Arturo Escobar. They're not environmentalists. They just look at how to, they're decolonialists. But that is the way to environmental liberation, is human liberation. And liberation theology, Black liberation theology, ecofeminism, ecowomanism, deep ecology, these are all terms, if you look that up, a lot of resources appear. And I wouldn't mind if you read our book as well, Religion and Sustainability.
What would be your definition of wonder?
The first moment I can remember feeling wonder is again, in nature, when I went strawberry hunting, you know, as a kid. And the strawberries you get in shops, you know, in supermarkets, are big, fat things, right? They're grown for consumption. And so my father would take me to the woods and we'd look for these. And then I would go with my friends and look for them too. But the first time I saw a natural strawberry, a strawberry growing in a forest floor, and it's this little tiny dot. And I'm like, what's that? They said, that's a strawberry. Pick it up. And I took it and I tasted it. And it was sweeter than any strawberry I'd ever eaten. And that's when I felt first moment of wonder. This is what the earth actually creates. That thing in the supermarket, that's what we create. And there's a difference.
Yeah. How would you describe your perception of what gratitude is for you?
You know, I think gratitude for me has been so strongly connected, aside from, you know, family and friends and mentors and so forth. Beyond that, I feel gratitude for strange things. I'll give you an example. Before coming to Northern California, I used to live in Arizona. I was in Arizona for 10 years. Arizona's, and the entire Southwest is a remarkable place. Beautiful, stunning, awe-inspiring, wondrous. And when I first went to Arizona and saw the foothill Palos Verdes, which you have in Southern California too, you know, it has green trunks, the new trees. And I'd never seen green trunks. And it was amazing. And then we went up to the mountains, the White Mountains of Eastern Arizona, and you pass through these rocks, these boulders, and the boulders look like someone carved them in Easter Island. They were amazing. They were remarkable. They're art. And then we went to the Grand Canyon. And it's almost unbelievable. When you sit there in the dawn, every human problem disappears. Every fear, every anxiety, even every hope disappears in a moment of absolute joy and awe. And then the red rocks of Sedona. I mean, when you see this, they look like cathedrals made of rock by nature. And in that experience, I felt gratitude for every one of those moments. I felt gratitude. The year we went to Arizona was a drought year. And then we arrived and there was a historic rainfall. And we went to the desert and the desert bloomed. The desert bloomed in an explosion of color in the midst of saguaro cactuses. You know, it was like paradise. And so gratitude becomes something not that you cultivate, but that grabs you by the jugular and explodes in your heart.
Wow. Well, I'm so grateful that you are helping explore that connection between theology, feminism, eco-consciousness. It's, as you said earlier, it's all hands on deck moment. And I think it's so important that we can have these conversations. I want to thank the Fetzer Institute because they help support this podcast and the great team that I also have here with Sarah and Brittany and Annie and Courtney and Kurt and Greta and Ginger that helps us make this podcast happen, and Sam as well. And I just wanted to really thank you, Rita, for this incredible conversation. It's opened my eyes to a lot of things I never thought about before.
Louis, it's been such a pleasure, and thank you so much for having me. It's always wonderful to get your insights. And I also want to thank the Fetzer Institute. I completed a project with them recently on our sacred story, you know, our human sacred story. They do wonderful work.
Yeah. They're the spiritual foundation for a loving world, right?
Yes.
That's what we all need. Okay. Thank you, Rita. Really appreciate it.
And thank you. Thank you, Louis, for your work. Okay. My students thank you as well.
Thank you. Brought to you by the Fetzer Institute, helping to build a spiritual foundation for a loving world.